So if I, first of all, I want to thank everybody for being here today. I want to especially thank the students, because I know you are all crazier than normal this week and next. So I'm really glad that you made the time, but I don't think you'll regret having taken time away from the papers that certain mean-spirited professors are making you write this week. God knows I'm glad I'm not like that. One of the problems in this discussion is that folks are coming with enormously different levels of background knowledge about the movement that we're using as a reference. And so the thing I most want to emphasize is I want you to be comfortable with asking some questions that you're seeing. Ask some questions from where you are right now, not worrying about how political they look, how well informed they look, or any of that stuff. Just ask questions that matter to you, right? I mean, that's the context you should be creating. If there were more time, you know, I would do my infamous 20-minute lecture on the history of the civil rights movement in Mississippi. So Mississippi is going to be the place out of which much of the conversation that we're going to be talking about today is generated. I'm not going to do that, right? I do want to make one point. So much of what we're talking about is going to be, this panel is focused specifically on the summer of 64, the freedom, so-called Freedom Summer. That summer is remembered for many reasons, right? That summer was the second most covered news story of the year 1964. The only thing that got more ink in that year in the American press was the presidential election. Part of the reason that summer gripped the American imagination so was the murder of Mickey Schwerner, James Cheney, and Andrew Bibb. Right. That summer literally changes American history, right? Everything's different on this side or that side. We're going to argue about the interpretations of what's different and what's good or bad. And particularly, as many of the panelists will say later, American activism has changed forever because of the events of that summer and the aftermath of that summer. The one point I want you to be real clear about, some of the bitterness that surrounds this story is about the way in which black stories are always centered by white stories. Right? One of the ways in which that figures into this history is that for a great many Americans, the Mississippi movement begins with Mickey Schwerner and Andrew Bibb, right? And with that history, right? So the only point I want to make is no, if I got to pick a beginning for the modern movement in Mississippi, I would probably say it's the post-World War II period, right? Mississippi, the percentage of black voting in Mississippi in 1940 is 3%, which is exactly what it would have been in 1900, right? There's no change over 40 years, right? By 1948, it's up to 12%. An enormous jump. It's the first change in the 20th century, the access of Mississippi blacks to the franchise, right? The modern movement is fully rooted in the 40s. It's rooted in part in the Supreme Court decision. It's rooted in part in 88,000 black veterans coming home and coming home with an attitude. White veterans are also coming home with attitudes, in a whole other way. And just to make this really clear, what I put on the board, we did this in 5 seconds, so this is nothing like thorough, right? But I just want you to know the names of some of the people who died explicitly for civil rights activity, mostly voter registration activity, in Mississippi over a 10-year period between the middle 50s and the middle 60s. So Robert Smith, the NAACP leader, started a voter registration campaign, disappeared and has not been heard from since. George Lee in Belzoni, Mississippi, essentially the same story. They just drove up to him and shot him to death the day before a mass meeting. Herbert Lee, I don't know, the SNCC story in Mississippi in so many ways, we have with Herbert Lee. And Bob is very close to this part of the... But a local person became deeply committed when SNCC came into the state. And again, I'm also saying SNCC does not... The movement doesn't stop with SNCC either, right? SNCC is coming in, it's building on an older indigenous movement, it's taking it to a new level of activity. But SNCC is starting the movement, Corey is starting the movement. Herbert Lee is killed in the course of SNCC activities. This immediately creates a context in which for the rest of their, I would say the rest of their lives, right? SNCC leaders feel responsible for these events, right? People who are coming out to new levels of involvement at their call and losing their lives, right? Edgar Evans, Clyde Kinnard, even though he died of cancer. It's a long story. I'll get somebody else to tell it, but I regard that as state murder, right, for his audacious act in trying to get himself admitted to the University of Mississippi. Lewis Allen, Bob, I'm going to ask you to start off saying something about the Lewis Allen stuff and how that connects to Freedom Summer, right? But that's sort of like the winter of 64.
It's just before, it's at the very end of 63.
The very end of 63.
Yeah.
Okay. Then the famous ones from the summer, Mickey Schroeder, James Chaney, Andrew Goodman, and then Vernon Dahmer, 1966. So on the day, I should have brought this quote. We're going to get a bunch of quotes in the next 10 minutes. But Vernon Dahmer, when the Civil Rights, I'm sorry, the Voting Rights Act is passed, goes on the radio and says something like, anybody who is afraid to go downtown to pay your poll tax, you bring your poll tax to my store, I'll pay your poll tax for you. Anybody who doesn't have the money to pay poll tax, you come tell me, I will pay your poll tax for you. His home was firebombed that night. His wife and daughter were horribly scarred. He survived only because he got a gun and turned out to be the Klan. He got a gun and defended his family from the front door while they got out the back, right? That's not the last, right? But I'm just trying to give you a sense of how serious this period was, right? And the stakes of it. But I don't know, for some folks, the fact that they lost their job in civil rights activity, the fact that they could not get medical care for themselves, their children, the fact that you could not get your crops out of the ground, right? For all this period, the power structure squeezed activists in every way they could, right? And that's only the tip of that iceberg. Right? Okay, so that's enough by way of background, and you know, you'll fill in with the panelists will fill in. I'm sorry.
What is
SNCC? Sorry, thank you for asking that. SNCC is the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, the organization which formed other sit-ins in 1960. Next spring will be its 50th anniversary. It is the organization which is very much the left wing of the civil rights movement. In its initial phase, it is black young people, along with some whites, I would say overwhelmingly southern whites. Now, again, this is all open. They will not hesitate or correct me if I get this right. In the early period, and that's important, right? The southernness of the first white people of this SNCC. It is very much, I argue that SNCC is the model for 1960s activism. Howie is more expert on this than me, but to some degree, I'm going to read your passage from Howie in a minute, right? He talks about the way in which SDS was responding to black revolutionaries and black activists. Much of what we think of as the activist style of the 1960s grows out of SNCC, and its aggressiveness and its militance. Black power growth comes out of SNCC, which is the subject of our next panel. But thank you for asking that. So that's probably everything I need to say by way of background, except to introduce the panel and the panelists. And I will do that first by taking us back to that title. I want to be your friend, you black idiot. I want you to have the historical context out of which that comes. This is Sally Dolphage's Freedom Summer, which is just a beautifully written book. And Bill Belfridge is one of the volunteers. I should have said, right, that the basic idea of Freedom Summer is that the movement, and it's Lewis Allen Killian which sort of brings this into final perspective to some folk, between 1961 and 1963-ish, is able to generate a certain amount of momentum around the right to vote among blacks in Mississippi. But people are still being killed, right? And the decision that has to be made, in 1964, is what the hell are you going to do about that? Your people are being killed, right? One response to that is to bring in, if the nation has demonstrated clearly, it doesn't care how many black people get killed struggling for the right to vote. So what is your response to that? Your response to that is to bring to Mississippi some people that the law cares about, right? That means upper middle class white folks. And when they come, some degree of protection will come. That's more or less the thinking behind Mississippi's Freedom Summer. One of those volunteers is Sally Dolphage. This is her memoir of that period. And what she says, those SNCC Negroes, we were all Negroes then, they were automatically suspicious of us, the white volunteers. Throughout the summer, they put us to the test, and few, if any, could pass. Implicit in all the songs, tears, speeches, work, laughter, was the knowledge secure in both them and us that ultimately we could return to a white refuge. The struggle was their life sentence, the planet and their pigment, and ours for only so long as we cared to identify with. They resented us, and this was as difficult for some volunteers to assimilate as it was understandable. The volunteers wanted gratitude, and they could not understand, and they couldn't understand why there was instead a tendency to use them simply as the most accessible objects of Negro anger. This manifested most often in exercises of status, self-condescension, which acted to diminish any self-importance, bloated white pride. It humbled, if not humiliated, one to realize that finally they will never accept me. And this raised the question, why then am I here? If they're not grateful for my help, if we're supposed to be struggling for brotherhood and can't even find it among ourselves, why am I here? This was each one's private battle, rarely discussed. To do so would have meant admissions giving words to certain uncomfortable doubts. Over and over in Ohio, the training had happened in Oxford, Ohio, and there will be a big commemoration there this fall of that training. Over and over in Ohio, they had told us that we were all victims of the very prejudice we fought. How could this be so? We were forced to examine ourselves meticulously for symptoms of the disease. Yet those who exonerated themselves could see no contradiction in their innocence and their parallel desire for gratitude. Why gratitude? The battle was as much ours as theirs, and to expect thanks was somewhere to feel superior to that battle. But we didn't have to come, did we? We could have stayed at home and gone to the beach, or earned the money we so badly needed for next semester at old Northern White. And there we are, we came. Among all the millions who could have realized their responsibility to this revolution, we alone came. Few Northern Negroes even came. We came. Don't we earn some recognition, if not praise? I want to be your friend, you black idiot, was the contradiction evident everywhere. Obviously, that phrase, not frustration, right? And we talked about yesterday about how some of this tracks very directly with how some of us see what is happening in schools on the South Side and the West Side, right? And new teachers, usually white, not always, coming into those schools with attitudes which track directly with the attitudes that she is describing. So the degree to which this overlaps with the kinds of issues that we have in our personal and professional lives here and now, I don't think that, you know, it's obvious, right? We are going to talk about that somewhat. And let me now introduce the panelists. The real introduction you have is one of these blue sheets around you. Let me give you my made-up introductions, which will be different. For Bob, I'm going to stick with Sally Belford. She's describing a meeting in Greenwood. Were you a project director?
I was acting project director for a while after Stokely had other business he had to go to.
Let's leave that alone.
I was a fallback.
Okay. So you served for Stokely. That sounds good to me. Belford is describing a mass meeting in Greenwood in the summer of 64. Bob comes to the platform. Bob had joined the local project in voter registration, later becoming project director. He was from Alabama, a Methodist minister's son, SNCC's first white field secretary, a graduate of the best Southern prisons, and a master of language, a solid brown-haired gentleman. His confident grin and gestures supplemented his words, and he had the case. He spoke just as they did. Sure was hot, then he began easily, until that cloud came along. That's right, the church, the meeting responded. And we were sitting on the front porch talking about freedom. I think we're going to get us some freedom, do you? Crowd registered an excess of enthusiasm for him, a white Southerner with them, of them. The people in Greenwood are getting shook up, he said. Amen. Now I'm from Alabama. I've been in Alabama all my life. And I know you know white people, and I know white people. And I know when they're getting shook up, he attacked the question of block habit. Their jobs would be to find out who all is registered and who all is not registered. Now, some of you might have agreed to be a block captain and forgotten about it. He encouraged more to volunteer, remove some of the doubts, try to clarify the distinction between registering at the courthouse and freedom registering for the freedom vote to the movement. Probably for the Freedom Democratic Party. It's still important to go on down and stand outside Lady Lamb's door. She was the registrar. And nobody got to worry none about the little old deputy with the big old gun. Right? If Miss Jones tells you that she's going to lose her job if she goes down to the courthouse, you just tell her that you don't get freedom for nothing. We've been suffering so long, and we don't have anything to begin with. So you might as well give up those three pennies. If everybody goes down, you know they can't fire everybody in town. If they have trouble with their job, they should come to us and make out an affidavit, and we'll do our best. That's true as far as it goes. After that, it's up to the Lord. You tell him, brother. With Bob Spoke, it was always a dialogue. He was the only white man who could do that. I asked him once, what does your father think of you? He smiled a slow, lit-up smile. He thinks a lot of it, he said. He's an old rabble-rouser, too. And his father? Well, before that, they were just a long line of rednecks. So that's Bob. Sahara, she calls her grandmother Mama, right? Real close, right? Largely raised you, right? And saved you from the cotton field. The grandmother said, I have picked enough cotton for me and you both, right? So Hara goes off, gets a scholarship to Spelman, got no more sense and start getting involved in demonstrations at a time when people are losing their scholarships for being involved in demonstrations. She gets involved in this one demonstration after she tries to keep her life separate, right? And to live the life of an activist and not let either her family or the people at school know. She gets involved in one demonstration, and the Atlanta Constitution the next morning says, Spelman girls arrested for disorderly conduct, right? And so she's famous in the worst kind of way. The dean, who's already mad at her because she got an afro, right? It had to be one of the first afros that I can find anywhere. The dean calls her in, reminds her that she was on a scholarship. Her scholarship is now in jeopardy. And then the final thing from the black colleges, we're going to call you home. All right? So the dean calls Fanny's grandmother, and Zahara, grandmother, and then makes Zahara call her grandmother. Making that call was one of the worst moments of my life. Of course, Mama was very upset. She said that I had disgraced the family and reminded me that I was the first person in our family ever to be arrested. She sounded so sad, so pained. Her voice was low and husky. It was the same voice she had used all my life, just before she would go out to the backyard and cut a strong switch. Thank God there were over 800 miles between us. She said that the dean had told her that I could lose my scholarship and be expelled from school. She told me that if the school didn't kick me out and send me home in disgrace, I had better mend my ways and stay clear of those marches in this snack organization. She said it with such venom, whatever that was. Clearly my wee hope that Mama would be proud, and this next part captures the real complicated relationship across generations, right? The way in which the older generation both try to hold you back and protect you, but they had inspired you to do it in the first place. Clearly my wee hope that Mama would be proud of me for going to jail for Negro's rights was that. I had seen her stand up to some white policemen with a shotgun across her forearm, who were roaming around without authorization in our backyard late one night looking for a suspect. Hadn't she told me the stories about Grandma Lucy during slavery and her own struggles as a sharecropper with unscrupulous white landlords? Hadn't she told me all my life, white people are dirty, they'll kill a Negro just as soon as look at them? Wasn't she proud that I was standing up to them and fighting for what was rightfully ours? I knew if she didn't support me, that my mother's father, who had questioned my going to school in the first place, certainly would not understand. I was heartbroken. I went to my room, got in my bed, and cried until my pillow was wet. And then she eventually winds up going to Mississippi, right, and becoming the project director in the summer of 64. This one, Fanny Rushing, who was from Chicago. Some of the SFA students know her from her beginning of the year. Bus tours. There is one of the most powerful ideas, I would argue, to come out of Mississippi Freedom was the idea of the Freedom School. The idea of trying to create an education that would help young people, mostly young people, and we have a couple of Freedom School folks in this Freedom School, I think, in this group. see themselves as agents of change that would help them develop a critique of society, and would help them develop an understanding of their own ability to change that society. Right? Fanny Rutschman, who worked with Chicago, with SNCC and Chicago, friends of SNCC, is one of the co-founders of what, so far as I know, the only residential freedom school to come out of SNCC. There is a well-regarded academic, and partly what's interesting for me is the tension between how academics, the best of the academics, understand history, and the difference between that and the understandings brought by people who were part of the history, right? The more nuanced kind of understanding. He has written a very, very well-regarded piece on the history of freedom schools, in which he demonstrates at great length and with all the usual scholarly apparatus, right, how much impact freedom schools had on the individuals who went to them, right? Fanny says something like, no boy, that is not the way to think about this. That is not the way we thought about this, right? So she says, the U.S. system can tolerate protest so long as it is individual. The objectives of the traditional school are to promote individual self-reliance, autonomy, and achievement. The objectives of the freedom school and the pedagogy of Paulo Freire was to be transformative social agents. They were not predicated, as the article seems to indicate, on individual self-validation. Looking within oneself for the ability to eradicate oppression is only the first step. It's not an end in itself. The basic idea initially, it seems to me, was to be able to identify the issues of local oppression and relate that to the country, state, national oppression, and for each person to understand his ability and connection with others to change oppressive conditions. Freire's idea was each one teach one. Again, the emphasis was not on individuations, but on social change for the benefit of the larger group. Similarly, one of the objectives of the Freedom School was the improvement of life chances, not just for the individual, but for the group. And Sue Thrasher. I think this book will be on sale in the lobby, deep in our hearts. This is nine white women talk about the civil rights movement. I believe the 60s started, it's nice to think of this quote, by the way, in response to the first thing I read from Sally Dawkins, the feeling of the white volunteers and this notion about gratitude. I believe the 60s started in 1955 when Rosa Parks refused to move from the Montgomery bus and ended at some emphasized moment in the early 1970s, perhaps when four students were gunned down by National Guardsmen at Kent State. In the intervening years, the Southern Freedom Movement, characterized by the startling courage of black Southerners of all generations, march its way into the nation's consciousness, forever changing the landscape of the South and the nation. It was what one freedom worker called a dazzling moment of clarity, a moment when choosing between right and wrong had no blurry edges, and choosing the future over the past was essential. For that brief historical moment, believing we could create a community based on justice and equality, we did. And as the new millennium begins, we seem farther and farther away from resolving issues of racism that have plagued our nation's history. I become ever more grateful that I was privileged to have been a participant in what Jim Foreman calls the Band of Brothers and Circle. I'm sorry, that's what it is. What Jim Foreman called the Band of Brothers and Circle of Trust. Right? And what, again, I particularly want to call your attention to, in contrast to the kinds of attitude that Sally Dawkins was writing about, is this notion that what she had done was a privilege, right? As opposed, you know, privilege slash entitlement will form much of the basis of our discussion. And finally, Mr. Howard Mockinger, right? Drawing on his experience at SDS and the Weather Underground, and trying to explain, I don't know, what do you say, some of the excesses in that culture, points out that there was an eagerness to demonstrate in practice that white radicals could risk the same commitments as their revolutionary icons, the North Vietnamese and the Black Panther. We would not sell out or be co-opted. That's still the stance of many former members. Despite some bravado, I myself was a cautious person looking to break the shackles of bourgeois detachment. That's a powerful phrase, breaking the shackles of bourgeois detachment. I felt real relief in seemingly giving my all, but at the same time, I was terrified. Such existential acting out does not ordinarily lead to good political sense. The importance of demonstrating revolutionary credentials or moral purity gets in the way of clear thinking about how to strengthen the movement or take advantage of political opportunities. By allowing our frustration and revolutionary errors to trump our political common sense, we disowned one of the 60s era's organizers' greatest contributions to leftist politics. the revival of which has been called the organizing tradition. This was a tradition focused on long-term change in bottom-up politics that animated the civil rights, black freedom, women's liberation, and anti-war movements. This organizing tradition, which the Weather Underground abandoned, has a developmental, long-haul perspective and an emphasis on building relationships that endure. It respects collective leadership and holds that the best movement leaders should have ongoing and accountable relationships with their base, the grassroots. Its anti-bureaucratic ethos, the preference for connecting issues and organizing around people's everyday lives, create an expansive notion of democracy. This conception of organizing goes beyond mobilizing, disdains vanguardism, requires patience, and emphasizes the centrality of building new leadership. The organizing tradition was most fully embodied in the practice of early SNCC, but also revivified in the Women's Liberation Group and some SDS chapters. The fierce urgency of now is always with us, but the struggle to maintain one's humanity in building a movement for social justice in an oppressive world has an even more profound urgency. I actually didn't realize that it would take that time to read through that stuff. But I wanted you to have a sense of who they were in a way that, you know, just doesn't come through from the written autobiography, written biographies. So with that, Mr. Zellner, you can go anywhere you want.
Well, thank you. Now that's work. My brother is sweating, not from picking cotton, but from telling the story. Walking the walk, wearing big holes in the bottom of his shoes. Anyway, I'm Bob Zellner, and I was born in 1939, born and raised in L.A., Lower Alabama. That's a bit of geographical humor that we use to loosen up stiff crowds and say, hey, it's okay, because there's a lot of funny stuff in the movement. We relied on humor, we relied on music, we relied on religion, or now we refer to it as spirituality, and we relied on humor. And I want to start with a little story, because my introduction came from Greenwood, Mississippi. That would be the summer of 64 in the heart of the Delta in Mississippi. And I'll just tell you one quick story. During one of the huge demonstrations in Greenwood in the summer of 64, and those huge demonstrations amounted to what? Black citizens in LaFleur County, Greenwood, Mississippi, United States, lining up to do what? To become registered voters. And this was a capital crime in Mississippi. Five people, in the beginning of my work with SNCC, in the first 36 months, five people in my organization, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or people associated with it, were killed because they tried to get Americans to register to vote. This is in a country that at the same time was holding itself up as the great beacon of freedom around the world, the antithesis of godless communism. Whenever we got involved in the movement, you were under communist influence, which is what the Attorney General of the state of Alabama said to me after I went to meet Dr. Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks with four other students from my college. The Klan burnt crosses around our dormitory. Five of us were asked to withdraw from school because we had broken the segregation law going to Reverend Abernathy's church. The Attorney General called us in and said, you're under the communist influence. And I said, you mean this communist in Alabama? And he said, no, but they come through here. So when you got involved in the movement, if you were a white Southerner, you had to be very careful because somebody would sneak up on you and capture your mind. If you were interested in women's rights, organizing the labor unions, having good schools, and certainly doing anything about segregation or racial oppression, you were what? Under the communist influence. So in Greenwood, Mississippi in the 64, when those people lined up with great courage, after five people had been killed, three of them at the beginning of that very summer, three people killed. A worldwide news around the world. Why? Because two of those three happened to be white students, white young people from New York. That was the first time we had a breakthrough in the consciousness of America about what's going on.
people had been killed over and over in the South. They were black. They were basically overlooked. But now, here are three white people killed. And the reason was very specific. The head of law enforcement in the United States, J. Edgar Hoover, at the beginning of the summer of 64, went on television and told the nation, and thereby the Klan in Mississippi, the people coming to Mississippi for the Freedom Summer from all over the country will have no protection from the federal government. Your protection will rely on local enforcement, which tells the Klan what? Federal government is having open season on civil rights workers. After the first week of orientation in Ohio, the first people to go into Mississippi for that, they were captured, taken out of jail in the middle of the night, brought to a dirt road, murdered after being beaten viciously. When they were found months or weeks later, 18 feet deep in an earthen dam, the doctor said, who did the autopsy, these bones were shattered like a high-speed aircraft crash. This is what happened to these three people, two of them white, two of them black. The black youth, Cheney, was not even identified by name in the press in the beginning. It was Andrew Goodman and Schwerner. And later on they learned James Cheney, a black youth from Mississippi. So when these people lined up in Greenwood in 64 at that courthouse to ask for that right to vote, they knew they were taking their lives in their hands. All of a sudden, I'm observing, because by this time I've become acting project director, which was very unusual for a white person. But Foreman said, Stokely has to go to Tallahatchie County. There's a lot of things happening over there. So there's nobody here, Bob, that can do it right now. Will you do it until somebody comes along that knows what they're doing? So I was observing this day as the line was going into the courthouse or trying to get into the courthouse. A pickup truck sped up onto the grass of the county courthouse, came screeching to a halt. People tensed in the line, but they didn't break the line. They stood there, not knowing what to expect. Two white men jumped out of the pickup truck. They reached into the back of the truck and took out an object, not knowing still the people didn't know if it would be a gun, a bomb, or what. Out of the back of the pickup truck, they took a monkey about this tall. Ugliest monkey you have ever seen. The monkey had a sign on, and it had a little dress on, and had a sunbonnet. And the sign on the monkey said, I want to vote too. In the midst of this summer, where lives are being put at stake, these white men thought nothing more than to do an insult to the black people of Greenwood, Mississippi, who were taking their lives in their hands. Do you know what the response was? Immediately, someone in the line said, that is an insult to us. Those white people bringing that monkey here with a sign saying, I want to vote too. Someone else in the line said, don't bother those people. That 85-year-old white lady with that sign on, she has the right to vote too, just like me. That's not a white lady, that's a monkey. I bet you 20 people tell you to put down the monkey. I bet you, 20 would get you 40 if that's a monkey. That is an 85-year-old white woman if I have ever seen. Somebody looked at the white man. Sir, is that really an 85-year-old white lady there? Some people said that's a monkey. Well, that was the response of a great spirit in Greenwood, Mississippi. You can throw everything you want to at us. You can throw your monkey at us and everything. We're going to laugh at you now because you have no more power. We have decided we will not cooperate any longer with your system of segregation. So that's what it's all about. When we talk about minority participation in majority movements, one of the things that we have to consider is what is the assumption of that? I'm a white Southerner. I was involved in the movement. And I remember years after I was involved in the movement, people would say to me, Bob, what made you go South to help the black people? I'd say, wrong, Moose Breath. I didn't go South. I was already South. Two, I didn't go to help black people. I first went to help myself. I was not free I was born in a police state. I was raised in a police state. My daddy was a Ku Klux Klansman. My granddaddy was a Ku Klux Klansman. My uncles and aunts are Ku Klux Klansmen. When we had a march in Birmingham, my mother sent me a telegram, said, "Bob, drop out of the march going through Birmingham because your granddaddy is going to kill you. He's going to shoot you with a shotgun." And I knew that she wasn't joking. At my grandmother's funeral, my cousin said to me, "Bob, if we weren't at grandmother's funeral, I would kill you." And I said, "Charles, I'm Bob. I'm your cousin. We love each other. I love you, yes, but I would kill you. I would have to kill you." That's the violent code of ethics in the South, where white people were supposed to stick together. So when I joined the movement, I didn't join as a majority person, join a minority movement. I joined the movement for my own freedom. Now, there's a difference between liberals and revolutionaries. And we can understand that when we discuss social progress and movements. A liberal, to me, would be a white person, maybe, who wears their guilt on their sleeve. They say, "I have never been able to do enough to make up for the guilt of all myself and my ancestors and everything." Well, a liberal, basically, is a reformer. And it was Henry David Thoreau who said, and I'll draw to a close on this. Henry David Thoreau said, "For every reformer and every liberal," I'm paraphrasing now, "who is hacking at the leaves and branches of evil and oppression, there is one radical who is hacking at its root." See, a radical is a revolutionary. A radical, a revolutionary, is not a liberal. A liberal is a compromiser. A liberal is a moderate. If you want to be a liberal and you want to be a reformer, that's good. I appreciate it. You do a lot of help. You do a lot of good. But when you see babies coming down the river and you keep rescuing the babies and you don't go upriver to find out who the heck is throwing babies in the river, then I think you are an idiot. And if you choose to be an idiot or a liberal or a moderate, that's okay. We chose otherwise. We chose otherwise. We understand that social work and the social revolution, and sometimes they can be done together, and sometimes we misunderstand that if we have a political position, we need everybody else to agree with our political position in every single detail. We don't. We work together. But we are the vanguard. We are the people who take the action and make the change. In every age, every revolutionary is a member of a minority. The majority never makes the revolution. They become a part of the revolution. The majority in the civil rights movement, which was a mass movement, didn't really take the action in the beginning. They joined the movement and they came. There's a new movement afoot now, and it's related to the movement that we made 60 years ago. There's a huge debate in my own organization now that tends sometimes to be a little ultra-leftist. We wanted to invite the president to come to the 50th anniversary of SNCC. And a lot of SNCC people who pride themselves on being on the left always, "Oh no, we couldn't possibly have the president come. It would take away from what we're going to do at our meeting." Now, I asked them, what did we do in 1964? We risked our lives and people died to get black people registered to vote. To do what? To elect black officials. What is the president? The first black president of the United States. We also invited Kennedy and Nixon to come to the second meeting of SNCC. So when we get involved with ourselves, then yes, we can invite the president, we need to, we have to, or no, it would never do to invite the president. We're just carrying on our everyday struggle. Hopefully we will invite the president. If we don't, we'll settle for Michelle. She can come and represent the president. Nicole, where's Nicole? Yo, okay. That's a resemblance there. Thank you.
I learned something about Bob, but I'll tell you what I learned later. I don't want to jump ahead. I learned a lot, but I didn't know that we had something else in common, and I'll get to it.
Oh, okay.
First of all, hello everybody, and thanks so much for coming out. what I love about what's happening here is that it's really been is a reunion for some of us who worked together when we were your ages. And, you know, now some of us are in our sixth decade and, you know, still kicking. And it's really great to hear our stories and share our reflections and our understandings. As you already have heard, I was a student at Spelman and very reluctantly got involved with SNCC. I mean, I wanted to, but I also, you know, was so scared about losing this possibility to go to college and live the middle class existence, because, you know, that was what I really wanted. I mean, I wanted a nice house, I wanted a nice car, I wanted not to be worried about, you know, how I was gonna put bread on the table and stuff. I didn't want to live like I had lived growing up. Not that we didn't have bread, but I was around people who didn't have bread. And so I believed that education was the ticket out of poverty. And so that's what I went to Spelman bound and determined to get. And then, you know, I get there and there's a movement going on. And I knew in my heart that what was happening was right. And I was so glad. But I, as Charles mentioned, I tried to stay out of it. I wasn't able to stay out of it. And as I played all kinds of games, you know, I'm just going to go up to the SNCC office and clean offices a little bit. They need help here. And my daughter can tell you I have a fanaticism about cleaning. And so, you know, let's dump trash. And, you know, nobody will know I've been up here, you know. So that's how I started. And then typing and then mimeographing. And then, you know, I'm not going on a march. I'm not doing it, you know, because if my mama finds out, grandmother, if school finds out, I'm out of here. Anyway, you know, I little by little did march and did get arrested and the like. Now, moving forward, I was very blessed to have so many wonderful people teach me, influence me. Staunton Lind, whom if you don't know about, please Google him and look at some of his work. He was a young history professor there. Howard Zinn was a professor at Spelman at the time. Vincent Harding was head of the Mennonite House, and there's some information about Vincent on the table. And of course, SCLC was there, SNCC was there, and SNCC was always on the Atlanta University campuses chiding us, sometimes in very harsh terms, by calling us handkerchief head N-I-G-G-E-R-S's and Uncle Tom's and Thomasina's and the like for not being involved in the movement. So one of the things that happened was that Staunton Lind, who had been my history professor both of the 2 years that I was at Spelman, was working on the development of the Freedom School curriculum with Ralph Featherstone, Charlie Cobb, who were both SNCC activists. And I volunteered as his student to work with him. I'd also been elected to be on the coordinating committee of SNCC, representing the Atlanta University Center. There were two representatives from each school that made up SNCC's coordinating committee. And so I knew about this Mississippi Summer Project that was being planned. And more I thought, oh gosh, I need to go, I want to go. But at the same time, I knew that it would be over my grandmother's dead body that I'd be able to go, because all my life I had been told that Mississippi, you know, as Nina Simone said, God damn, I mean, you know, it is the hell hole. I mean, my grandmother's thing was, don't ever go to Mississippi. And this was long before the movement. it was like, to her, it was the worst place for black people. So I'd been brought up with that, and so clearly I was afraid to go. Nonetheless, I did sign up to be one of the summer volunteers, and after, you know, the school found out, because I told colleagues, you know, my schoolmates, somehow it got back to the dean. The dean, of course, immediately called my home, and at the end of the semester, I had planned just to slip away and not return home. At 6 o'clock in the morning, the house mother, we had house mothers in our dorms, knocked on the door, woke me up, and told me that I had company. Well, you didn't have company at 6 a.m. on the dorm at Spelman College, because nobody was allowed in there at that time, so I couldn't imagine, and of course, it was my grandmother, and my mother and my stepdad, and they said, we heard that you have lost your mind, and so we've come to take you home. You are not going to Mississippi. And it was like, oh my God, okay. So, you know, I went home. And I was steadily calling back to Atlanta, collect to the SNCC office, talking to Ruby Doris, Jim Foreman, saying, I don't have any money. How am I going to get back, you know? And so SNCC sent a bus fare. And that got intercepted by my grandmother, who tore it up. And then I thought, I called back and said, she got it. I need it sent again. Not to my house. I've got another place you can send it. So another money order was sent, and to my girlfriend's house in her name. And so she was able to cash it and give me the money. And the day that I left, going back to Atlanta, it was all arranged that I was going to stay at Storton and Alice Lynn's house until it was time to go to Ohio for the orientation. And then, of course, I didn't know where I would be assigned. One of the ways that I was able to tell myself that I might survive the summer was because of the white volunteers. You know, having been involved in the planning, I knew that as many as 1,000 volunteers, most of whom would be white college students, I still, you know, thought, well, the government's going to have to protect them. And so maybe that means some of us black folks will be protected too. So that's how I was able to overcome the fear and go. When I got to Atlanta, I was put on the staff of SNCC, which made me eligible to get our $10 checks, our paydays, $10, and after tax a week, it was $9.64 or something after they took our taxes. So that gave me some money, because I came there with maybe a couple of dollars in my pocket and nothing else. And of course, I forgot to mention that when I left, my grandmother said, if you leave, don't ever come back. So anyway, when Storton and other folk drove up to Ohio for the orientation, I basically was asked to stay for 2 weeks. There was 500 people the first week, 500 almost the second week. I had by chance gotten to meet Cheney and Goodman that first week. And then they all left, and the second group came. And about the middle of the second week, we were all called in, and it was very somber. You know, we wondered what's going on. You know, they broke away from our schedule. And Bob Moses, Jim Foreman, Vincent Harding, I don't remember who else was up on the stage, looking very grim. And they told us, you know, sit down, be quiet, and they then told us about the three workers missing, being missing. And they said, there's no way that they're missing. They're dead. Well, you know, the hush that went over the room was just palpable. We were like, dead? I mean, my God. I mean, how could that be? And of course, I was thinking, two white guys dead? Oh, wow. You mean they're going to kill white people too? So that was a real blow to my survival strategy. That really shocked me, you know. I mean, I was shocked for many reasons, but, you know, as I've told you, I was trying to tell myself I might survive the summer because there were whites going. Anyway, we got our assignments. I was told that I was going to a place called Laurel, Mississippi. I've never heard of Laurel, Mississippi. Is it? Where is it?
It's south.
I see Meridian, Laurel, here. Yeah, yeah. And I was like, you know, I'm not going to Greenwood, Greenville,
safe place.
Meridian, not safe, but I knew you guys. I mean, Meridian, you know, some of the big places where there were, you know, the field staff whom I'd met over the last year and a half, you know, I was like, Lord, I never even heard of it. So they say, yeah, it's in Jones County, and we can only send a small group of you there because, first of all, we don't have any housing for you there. There's really nothing set up there. So you're going to have to stay in Hattiesburg, Mississippi, and just south of Laurel, about 30 minutes, hey, right here. And then they said, then you'll, you know, we do have a list of names, and you'll just go up there and make a project. I was like, make a project? Really? How in the hell are we going to do that? You know, and they said, well, Lester McKinney, who was the person who had been in Laurel, knew the area, he was the project director. And Lester was a college student who had dropped out from Howard University. And the other person was Jimmy Garrett, who was from L.A., never been South, African-American, never been South in his life. So there the three of us are, and I said, is this it? And they said, this is it. And I said, do you know white people going? They said, no, it's too dangerous. And I was like, well, I ain't going. You know, if it's too dangerous for them, God knows it's too dangerous for me. So they were like, well, you know, later we'll send in some once you all set the project up. I was like, I know I have made a mistake, but it was like, you know, nobody was pulling out, so I couldn't pull out either. Then I didn't have anywhere to go, so it was like, okay, I'm going. So to show you how really crazy I was, sort of, I mean, my way of facing it was to sleep the whole way in. And we drove in, and every, you know, of course you had to stop and make your pit stops along the road somewhere, because, you know, once you crossed the Mason-Dixon line, you didn't have any toilets you could go to. So, and as we got deeper and deeper, and when they woke me up, Jimmy and Leston said, we just crossed into Mississippi. Well, I kept looking, and I said, this is Mississippi. Well, it looks normal. I mean, I don't know what I thought it was going to look like, you know, the haunted village of some strange imagination I had about the place. Anyway, so we were based in Hattiesburg, and we started driving up, and I guess the story that I always tell is I had my list, and Susie Ruffin was on that list, a woman who came to become one of the leaders in that city. Then I had a woman named Eberta Spinks on the list. And so this is the problem when you start reminiscing. I got to hurry up. I go knock on her door, and Jimmy and Lester are going to another house. So they drop me at her house, and she comes to the door, and I introduce myself to her as my name was Gwendolyn Robinson. Everybody called me Gwen Robinson. And I started telling her I was COFO and, you know, trying to explain what we were trying to do. And she said, are you one of those freedom riders? Well, I didn't know if that was good or bad. So I kind of paused and I said, yes, ma'am. And she said, girl, come on in. I've been waiting on you all my life.
Wow.
And I was like, oh my God. And so, you know, into her house I went, and that was the beginning of the Laurel Project. She was like, what you need, and I said, well, it's just three of us, we don't have anywhere to stay, our stuff is down in Hattiesburg, etc. She said, let me call Carrie across the street, she'll put the two guys up, you can stay here, go get your stuff, you know. So anyway, that just shows you the kind of, we were catalytic agents, we brought in some resources and some organizing skills and all, but the backbone were the people who were there, who had been fighting in whatever ways they could and doing whatever they could. All right, we get a project. We're going, with the three of us fairly well, and we let the people in Jackson know, the people in Atlanta, and then they start sending volunteers. Then one day, Lester disappears, and we don't know where he is, There's no disappearing without, somebody calling. We had walkie-talkies. We didn't know where he was. He left in a car with a walkie-talkie. And, of course, immediately you call Atlanta, you call Jackson. We don't know where he is. Well, it takes a couple of days of folks calling from Washington down to, and we find out he's locked up. And they wouldn't, of course, let him make any phone calls or make any contacts. As it turned out, Lester had been arrested when he had been doing some reconnaissance work prior to the Mississippi summer, and had been arrested and had not, of course, gone back for his trial and had an outstanding warrant. I don't know what he was thinking, but anyway, that's what they picked him up on once they found out he was in the city. And by the time the lawyers got there, it was clear that they were planning on giving him some big time in parchment. The only way he wasn't going to get that time was that he had to swear not to step foot back into Jones County for 5 years. And so the lawyer said, hey man, this is what you need to do, let's get you out of here, and that's what he did. So that basically left Jimmy Garrett, myself, and a couple of volunteers who had already arrived. And that's when Jim Foreman said, you have to become the project director until we can send somebody in there who knows what they're doing. So that's
they're lying.
So, 16 months later, I was still project director. They hadn't found anybody to send in. So that's how I became the project director, against my protestations and every, for a while, keep asking them, who are you going to send, when they're coming, etc. But quickly, to wind up my intro to this segment, we had 22 volunteers, 19, if you count Jimmy and myself, there were two other African Americans from the North who were students who came. Everyone else were white volunteers. And we had a very successful project in, many ways. I mean, we were able to organize our chapter of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. We were able to get a freedom school going. We also got what was called a freedom daycare going, in fact, where little tiny kids were being brought. We also, of course, tangled with the Klan, and we refurbished an old dilapidated dance hall and turned it into our center. That was later firebombed, and no one would come to put the fire out, so we lost all of the materials, the books, etc., that we had. The issue of whites working, majority people working in minority movements, there were tensions, there were stresses. I mean, while there was a tremendous amount of bonding that went on, there were also the tensions, the stresses that had to do with black folk and white folks trying to work together who had never done it ever. When we talk later today, we'll be talking about the whole internalization of racism that many of us black folk had, feelings of inferiority brought on by living in a white supremacist world, and the problem that many of the whites, particularly the Northerners, came down with very superiority attitudes, who initially just couldn't believe they had to sort of follow directions from somebody who was, you know, Southern, who was black, who was female, and who was the same age, and in some cases younger than themselves. So there were a lot of struggles. One last thing is that the issue of sexism, that was big, and we had a lot of sexual harassment of women, local women, volunteers in the movement, and that had been going on, you know, long before Mississippi Summer Project. I had witnessed it. I had been a victim of it, including attempted rape by a SNCC person whom I revered, who was a Mississippi field staff, and that happened in Ohio before I even got to Mississippi. So the rape was only didn't occur because my roommate came in and was able to intercept a beating that I was being given by a man who was a SNCC field staff person. So when I reported that to the people organizing, I was told, we don't have time for that. We are dealing with life and death situations. Well, I thought I was in a life and death situation when this guy was trying to rape me and beating me up. Nonetheless, I'm, you know, not having any idea I was going to become a project director. But one of the first things that I did was to say, if any man on this project, white or black, if any of you try to force yourself on a woman in this project, you are out of here. And so as a result of that, at some point later, they started calling, especially after the summer project, when there were two white women and myself who carried on that project. They called us the Amazon Project. And many men said they were not going to work with us because of the stringent sexual code they had to abide by. So anyway, questions will be about you.